Welcome back, and joining us live from Auburn, Alabama, in the Mises Institute is Dr. Mark Thornton. Mark, how you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing great, Al. It's great to be on the show with you here Monday morning.
Well, it's good to have you on. Based on our email exchange over the weekend, you know, I had a listener send me an article from a guy who gets into some detail on fractional reserve banking and using that as the reason that we're not seeing any inflation at the moment. I argue, based on the way inflation was tallied under Ronald Wilson Reagan and also under Bill Clinton, that we are seeing inflation. In fact, we are seeing a lot of it in the equities market, and we're exporting a bunch of it. Could we first speak to how the U.S. exports inflation?
Well, that's a very complex question, Alan, but basically, if the Federal Reserve is printing money here in the U.S., and it's trying to drive down the value of the dollar in order to enhance our exports, what happens is that other countries react to that, and they start inflating their own currencies to try to keep their currency value in line with the U.S. dollar or even driving it down. You know, we have the Japanese central bank actively trying to drive down their yen so that their exporters can compete here in the U.S., and so it's a beggar-thy-neighbor policy amongst central banks around the world. If you look at the United States, China, Japan, and the European Union, and the European Central Bank, they're all trying to drive down the value of their currencies. And so we're seeing big-time inflation, you know, here in the U.S. and in a lot of different areas. You know, when the Fed is printing money, prices are going to rise somewhere in the economy. It doesn't necessarily show up in the CPI, especially the one that the government is managing and editing over time. But we're exporting this inflation. And so, you know, the Chinese are trying to stay level with us, and that's causing their prices to rise and even riots over there. And they're rushing into the market to try to buy gold and silver. Prices are rising in Japan. Prices are rising in, particularly like in Brazil. They're having a hard time keeping inflation in check there in Brazil. So they're, you know, we have a federal funds rate of 0.25%. Their actively managed interest rate in Brazil is over 10%. They're trying to keep keep inflation at bay over there because we're exporting that inflation to countries like Brazil and around the world.
Well, let's talk about Japan for a moment. They're, what, over 20 years now into destroying their currency. And I know from the most recent economic report that came out of Japan, their trade deficit has swollen. And it's because, I mean, it was increased basically because they're paying more. They're not importing any more than they were a year or two ago. They're just paying more for it. So I'm always baffled by how these countries think that weakening their currency is somehow helpful to their population.
Well, Alan, that's a great example of how this beggar-thy-neighbor policy amongst central banks actually backfires on the consumers and the citizens of the country that we're looking at. So Japan tried to push down the value of the yen, its currency, in order to stimulate exports. But as most people know, you know, Japan has to import virtually all of its raw materials, all of its energy, all of its, you know, most of its metals. And, you know, so it's a big importer as well as an exporter. And when they drove down the value of the yen, that means that the price of all of their imports rose. And so, you know, they're basically a manufacturing and design center in Japan. They don't have a lot of agricultural products. They don't have a lot of energy products. And so the price of all those things rose in tandem with the fall in the yen. And so they're just, as you point out, they're not, their quantity hasn't, of imports hasn't risen, but the price of them has. And so that is what causes the trade deficit, so that they're buying more than they're selling. And, you know, and so they basically shot themselves in the foot as far as that aggressive inflationary fighting deflation process. And, you know, in countries all over the world, it's not just Japan. It's all the major economies, as well as Switzerland is trying to keep its the value of its currency competitive, so to speak, against the euro. And Norway and Sweden and Finland are also trying to keep their currencies level with the euro. And so everybody's following this song and dance initiated by the Federal Reserve of keeping interest rates at zero and putting downward pressure on the dollar. And we're seeing the impact of it on countries around the world. And it's very destabilizing and it's very unsettling. And it creates a lot of uncertainty with respect to entrepreneurs who are trying to invest into this nightmare. And the fact that entrepreneurs are so uncertain with respect to currency values makes them not want to invest. It makes them very unsure of where to invest their money. And that's one of the big laggards we've seen on the world economy is the fact that entrepreneurs are not interested in investing.
Where is it, though, that they get taught all this stuff? I mean, it just seems to me that it's common sense that the stronger your currency, the better for your people. And yet these central bankers have always taken, at least for the bulk of my lifetime, the opposite position, that they'll talk a strong dollar, but they do the opposite. They are always striving to weaken the dollar. Where do they get off thinking that that is helpful? I cannot connect those dots.
Well, they shouldn't be connected, Alan. It's you know, mainstream economics, the economics that's taught in college classrooms around the country, is very wrongheaded. It's Keynesian based. It's an economics where the government is playing social engineer with the economy, and you know they're raising and lowering taxes, they're raising and lowering the budget deficit, they're raising and lowering the trade deficit, and they're raising and lowering the interest rates as if they were an engineer on a locomotive on a railroad trying to adjust the, you know, various parameters of the engine to fine-tune it, when, in fact, no one is able to fine-tune an economy. I mean, that's what the whole failure of socialism pointed out is that single minds cannot manipulate an entire economy. They can't know what's going on everywhere in the economy. And the only proper regulator of an economy is the marketplace itself, where all of the information from all the participants are accounted for in market prices, market interest rates, market value of the currency. All of those parameters have to be adjusted by marketplaces that are free and open and unmanipulated by government bureaucrats. And so it's a basic failure of economics in the classroom, and the fact that Austrian economics is basically not taught in classrooms about how markets work. If you go into a standard, everyday, ordinary classroom around the United States, basically you'll walk in and they'll be talking about some kind of market failure. And those market failures are generally caused by previous government interventions. And so it's basically an entirely wrongheaded approach that's been in place now for half a century. The Keynesian Revolution occurred during the Great Depression. It never has succeeded in practice. And basically, as you point out, the basic common sense of it, or lack thereof, means that it's never going to succeed. It's always just going to pile up increasingly larger errors, mistakes in the economy.
Didn't Keynes himself recant his economic theories towards the end of his life?
Well, you know, he didn't live very much longer than after his book basically came to fame. But a lot of observers think that Keynes would be horrified by what his practitioners and followers have succeeded in implementing once they gain power, and that Keynes had more respect for markets and had more respect for the foibles of bureaucracies because he himself was a bureaucrat. And so I think, you know, certainly a lot of the blame has to go to Keynes himself, but there's also additional blame to be dealt out with to the followers and practitioners and the people who have so-called advanced Keynesian economics, you know, there's post-Keynesian economics and new Keynesian economics. There's all sorts of variations of Keynesian economics, but it all basically boils down to the fact that one form of Keynesian economics or another basically is mainstream economics. It's what's in the textbook. It's what's taught in the classroom. And it's a mistaken foundation of economic analysis, and it's very harmful to the economy. And, you know, when Keynesian economics is ignored and markets are allowed to work in places like Hong Kong and Singapore, Japan and Germany after World War II, what we've seen is a great flowering of economic prosperity. And when Keynesian economics is put into place, as it is now in central banks around the world, we see this increasing economic chaos.
Mark, can you stay with me for another segment?
I'd love to.
We're speaking with Mark Thornton, Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute. And when we return, we're going to get into a little bit of fractional reserve banking as well as the money supply. We'll see you in a couple minutes. Welcome back, and joining us for another segment is Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute over in Auburn, Alabama. Mark, thanks for staying on with us.
It's great to be on the show, Alan.
Well, I always enjoy having you on. I like to talk economics. Can we switch over and talk about now the money supply? And a lot of the central planners, and I've heard this narrative over and over again. I heard one guy say if you hooked the inflation rate up to a heart monitor, it'd be flatlined. And yet we're seeing evidence of pricing inflation everywhere. But can we first of all define inflation in its historical context, how that was morphed into pricing inflation, and then the various ways we measure the money supply?
Yeah, certainly. And this is a very important distinction to be made between Austrians and mainstream economists. Now, Austrians, following, you know, history dating back until the existence of money, has always viewed inflation as an increase in the money supply. And I think the standard definition of it before central banking in the United States, say, 100 plus years ago, was a political increase in the money supply. In other words, where the government engineered an increase in the money supply beyond the natural flows of, in terms of the values of gold and silver. And so that's what the Austrians key in on, and I think everybody should key in on what the central bank is actually doing to increase or decrease the money supply. And, of course, the natural historical tendency is for the central bank to increase the money supply, and especially so when there's no constraints on it. And, of course, the central bank doesn't have the constraint on it today that the money that it increases has to be backed by gold and silver. And so since the establishment of the central bank in the United States in 1913, we've seen this ever-increasing tendency for government to increase the supply of money to its own benefit, of course. Now, on top of that increase from the central bank, the banking system itself can increase the overall amount of money in the economy by increasing the amount of loans that it creates in the economy. And so once the central bank increases the supply of money, the banking system, because it's a fractional reserve banking system, has what's often referred to as leverage, in that they can increase the supply of money simply by creating loans. No single bank can effectively increase the money supply on its own, but the banking system as a whole has this ability to increase the leverage that the Federal Reserve creates when it initiates increases in the money supply. It's all a very complicated process, but you can think of the banking system has the ability to increase the money supply $10 for every $1 that the central bank creates to initiate the process.
Okay, so the theory of the people who say we don't have any inflation right now is that due to the lack of lending, and I think that article totally overlooked how much lending is being done to the federal government, but due to the lack of lending, that has the reverse effect of fractional reserve banking, and then that actually takes money back out of the money supply.
Well, there, you know, obviously banks have shown a lot of reluctance to lend money into the economy. Now, there's a lot of money, as you say, being lent to the government itself, and then there's a lot of money just sitting on the sidelines. Banks have, as a result of the Fed, they have a tremendous amount of excess reserves because the Fed is paying them interest not to lend the money. And so they've got a sure bet at a very low interest rate where they can lend money that they've basically received from the Fed back to the Fed and get a small return. But it's at a very large amount. We're talking about more than, I think it's almost $2 trillion of excess reserves. Now, in the past, the banking system as a whole has not held any excess reserves because they've always found it profitable to lend it out. But in this environment, banks are very reluctant to lend money long-term because they rightfully fear that there could be price inflation and that they're, all the loans they make today would end up being underwater for them over the long haul. So they're not interested in lending money long-term to businesses and to households. And as a consequence, that's had a dampening effect on price inflation. And if that money gets out, what we're going to see is a tremendous amount of price inflation, no matter how you bother to measure it, whether it's the government CPI or your own personal basket of consumer goods that you have to go out and purchase every week and every month. But, you know, if we look around in the economy, that money is leaking out. It is increasing prices. We've seen home prices rise very rapidly in the sand states of Florida, Arkansas, Nevada, and California, you know, something along the lines of 20 to 25% increases in home prices in those states, the states that were hit the hardest.
You said Arkansas. Did you mean Arizona?
I meant Arizona, yes. I was just through Arkansas. That's where our last interview took place, so I guess that was on my mind. But, Arizona prices are up 25%. Florida prices are up 20%. California prices are up 25%. And also, you know, if you look at farmland prices in the Midwest at all-time highs, well beyond previous highs, if you look at the contemporary art market in New York or the Manhattan real estate market or the Washington, D.C. real estate market, you see, you know, prices skyrocketing, basically. If you look at commodity prices in a lot of areas, even gold prices are, you know, approaching $1,400 an ounce, so if you, you know, get beyond the spike up to $1,800, gold is really at the historically extremely high levels. And so oil prices approaching $100 a barrel. So if you look at the broad spectrum of things, if you look at the cutting edge prices, the prices on world markets, which, you know, Americans eventually see, but not necessarily do you see them immediately. On all these marketplaces, you see very high prices, historically very high prices. And so, you know, that money is getting out. And what I fear is that, you know, if all those excess reserves of banks ever got cut loose and into the economy and then got leveraged up through the banking system, you know, I just can't imagine where prices would end up.
Mark, let's talk about that notion, and we're down to about 3 minutes, of Bernanke is creating money out of nothing, lending it to the banks for virtually nothing, and then paying them interest on the money that the Fed lent them, not to lend the money out to the rest of us. How in the world could that be helpful to the economy? And what stretch of the imagination does it take to say that that activity would lower the unemployment rate?
Well, it doesn't help the economy, and you know the facts speak for themselves. What it does do is it helps the big banks because it stabilizes them. It's like giving them an IV, a morphine drip, and oxygen and all that kind of stuff to try to stabilize the patient, which is the nation's, you know, five or six largest banks and that are being impacted by these policies. Those are the ones where, you know, and Bernanke basically wrote his dissertation on what caused the Great Depression, and his conclusion was that it was a failure of the central banks to bail out the large banks that caused the Great Depression. And so, you know, if you were looking around for a guy, you know, if you were a large bank and you were looking around for a guy who was interested in and willing to bail out the big banks, well, Ben Bernanke is your man, because he's the guy that virtually wrote the book on, actually wrote the book on why you need to bail out the big banks if they get in trouble, and that's exactly what he's done. But bailing out the big banks is not the overall economy. It's not Main Street. It's not the average, ordinary economy out there. That's basically how it lines up. There's no, I don't have any expectations that bailing out the big banks is going to help the economy over the long run at all.
Mark, it's been a pleasure, buddy. It flies by. This is Mark Thornton, Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, and we'll have Mark on again real soon. Mark, thanks a lot, buddy.
MISES.org.
All right. Good talking.